Well, I had the privilege of being asked to open the and launch the exhibition of the National Portrait Gallery commemorating the centenary of Anzac, All That Fall, Sacrifice, Life and Loss in the First World War, particularly looking or trying to examine, in I think a very contemplative way, the impact on Australia of such terrible loss in World War One, but the fact that so many of the bodies, almost 50%, did not ever come home for people to grieve in the normal way, or you might say the normal way, and what the impact of that was, obviously and less obviously, on Australia and all of us who followed. As well as the exhibition, they brought out a book of essays. They commissioned a book of essays called All That Fall, one of which was written by a terrific piece by Raymond Gaita, the Australian philosopher, who's joining me now. And I wanted to talk to him because it made such an impact on me. Raymond, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Did you accept this invitation with ease? I get the impression...
No, not at all.
Not at all.
I was going to decline it at first. And when one thinks of a particular war, like the First World War or the Second World War, you feel, or at least I felt, that one has to have more historical knowledge than I in fact do. But then I realised that I had, in fact, in different contexts, ever since the 60s, because of the Vietnam War, been thinking about war and the conditions under which it can be fought, the conditions which at present are eroding what I think to be the possibilities of wars being fought justly, and most importantly, ways of trying to minimise the likelihood that if, and I think when, really, because I don't think wars are over for us, when we're in another war, we reduce the likelihood that our soldiers will have reason to feel shame for themselves. Or even if they don't actually feel shame, maybe because they've been brutalised, that there's minimal reason to drag them before an international criminal tribunal.
So it's about the conduct of war.
Yes, yes. Everybody acknowledges, really, that at some level of themselves, that you don't kill people unless you absolutely have to. But most wars are fought long before that time of necessity has arisen. Politicians will always say, what else could we do at this point? We must. But generally, it's not the case that we must.
Is that your conclusion? Because I got the impression that the essay takes, you go really admirably and candidly through all the sequence of your thinking, your confusions, if I can put it like that. And, you know, you do sort of say, I had to consider what it meant to be so emotional, but also, what would I do if Australia were under attack?
Yes, well, it came about because I was in England and because I had an immigrant childhood, for which I was very grateful. But when I got to England, I fell unexpectedly in love with it. And then
this is what, 30 years ago or something?
Yeah, it was 1972. And I started thinking, partly for reasons of convenience, that I might get a British passport. And that made me... And then I couldn't because I had to renounce it. And the word renounce is such a strong word. Well, I thought it was such disloyalty and ingratitude that I couldn't contemplate.
Didn't worry Rupert Murdoch.
And then I started thinking, what did it mean for me to be in Australia? And it soon got to my thinking, under what conditions would I come back to fight? And I realised I would come back under most conditions. In fact, I couldn't think of any under which I wouldn't.
So you're not a pacifist?
No, I'm not a pacifist. But I knew I would come to fight for reasons of loyalty to what I and my parents had received. And I had been given so much by the country. But also I was struck by the fact that I couldn't bear not to be where my friends were. And this is an aspect of this exhibition that we're talking about, plays on that. You know, your friends need you and so on. Are you going to let them down? And that's why I felt very strongly, after I was rather shocked by the propaganda posters, I really began to feel we have no right to condescend to this, because I doubt very much that we, who are now much more sophisticated in all sorts of ways, would be able to resist the more subtle propaganda to which we would be subject if we were fighting, you know, not in another series.
So, in other words, it's not as clear-cut to you, and that's certainly the impression I get, that we don't know how a different era's propaganda will work on us. And you one of the things you did say, almost at the end of the day, to use the cliche, you want to feel that we wouldn't joyously go to war, that we would always have be able to reserve the right to think that our enemy were human. And I wonder whether we think the beheaders of the moment are quite human, you know. I think it's a struggle sometimes. And that we would have exercised that sense that was there absolutely no other alternative. Now, how do you feel? Do you feel confident about that?
Well, there are two things. One is I feel very strongly, it's been right at the centre of my work all my life, that no matter how morally terrible a person's deeds, and no matter how morally terrible their character may be, and even if we can't find anything in their character from which we could imagine anything like remorse could grow, I believe such a person is owed an unconditional respect. That is, it's got nothing to do with esteem, just by virtue of their humanity. And so for me, the important question is, in turbulent times of conflict, how to retain that sense to the extent that we have it. And that's why I suggested, for example, in my contribution to that little book, that radically dehumanising propaganda in time of war should be regarded as a crime against humanity, because it erodes the conditions under which we could sometimes even find intelligible that we should respect our enemy.
Look, before I let you go, you also did discuss what this exhibition is so interested in, is the nature of the sort of inchoate nationwide sorrow that spread over the land of Australia post-World War I, where so many attitudes to grief shifted, women became far less expressive, they became more like the stoic, reserved men. And you quote the French philosopher Simone Weil, that prolonged sorrow is a form of madness, and that the way back, in order to honour those who've gone, is to actually accept that one's history of one's land contains moments of high points and vulnerability, as well as nobility and grandeur.
Yeah.
How much does this exercise you?
Oh, a lot. I mean, I've thought a lot about a love of country and its faults, what I call its false semblance, jingoism. Every love has false semblance. It's not just that, you know. Do you really love, or is it just infatuation? You know, do you love your children, or are you just terribly needy? You know, we're always asking these questions. And this is absolutely basic to our identity, a lot of people don't want to talk too much about these things, but everybody trusts that they love truly, not falsely. And it's part of my idea of conception of love of country, that you'd, as opposed to jingoism, is that you love truthfully and that you not be afraid of that truth. In fact, I say, no soldier wants to die in cloud cuckoo land. It's dishonouring a dead soldier to shroud everything myths is a complex word, but to shroud it in lies of one kind or half-truths or mawkishness or sentimentality, which are themselves modes of falseness, modes of the false. So I've tended to think of love of country as requiring a very serious concern for truthfulness about one's past and what one's doing as a way of honouring the dead. People, and this is the thing I learned from Simone Weil, people do get attached, you know, they do need roots, and they do want to be able to love without shame. And I think that as involving a kind of extended notion of the national interest, that it's in my interest as a citizen of this country, I want to say, to be able to love it without shame. And if somebody says, but for the sake of the national interest, we have to do such and such, I say, no, that's a narrow, a impoverished conception of national interest. It's part of our national interest that we don't torture. That's what I used to argue when the torture debates were on. And if you say we have to do it for our national interest, that's a narrow conception of what's for the common good. It must be true, because people who are jingoists don't realise they're jingoists. They want to love truthfully. Nobody wants to love falsely or with a lie. So, in a way, what I'm saying is just so flamingly obvious. Shouldn't be controversial.
Thank you for saying it, Raymond Gaita. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, pleasure.
And Raymond Gaita's essay is in the collection published by the National Portrait Gallery. It's a really small little collection, really worthwhile, released with the opening of their new exhibition, All That Fall, Sacrifice, Life and Loss in the First World War. And I contributed an article in The Drum, the latest edition of The Drum, if you care to go to it. And very keen to get your thoughts if you do happen to attend.